Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington. Ahead, an analyst speaks with us about Russia's objectives in Syria. We hear testimony from the U.S. ambassador to Yemen. We ask our social media expert if the Sino-U.S. cyber pact can deliver.
What you have here is a very basic, fundamental difference of opinion about what cybersecurity is.
And find out which legendary country music show celebrated its 90th birthday. It's right here on The Voice of America. There continues to be concern about Russia's military activity in Syria. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins me here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. In Washington Wednesday, U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby said Russia's intervention has done little to bring an end to the nearly five-year conflict.
What Russian military activity has done, or has the potential to do, is to exacerbate the conflict already ongoing inside Syria along sectarian lines. And as we've said before, that if there's a constructive role to be had by Russia against ISIL, then that's a conversation we're willing to have. I don't think we're at that point right now, given what they're hitting and what they're choosing to do with their military forces. But if what they're doing, and certainly if you look just intrinsically at where they're striking and who they're going after, certainly would lead one to conclude that what they're trying to do is to prop up the Assad regime. All that's going to do is prolong the conflict. In fact, make it worse. And that is not something that we're interested in furthering and having a dialogue in terms of Russian future activity.
Kirby also said Wednesday that no decision has been made on establishing a no-fly zone along the Turkish-Syria border. Regional analyst Zubair Iqbal, a scholar at the Washington-based Middle East Institute, told me Russia's objectives in Syria have not changed.
The whole purpose was eliminate all opposition to the Assad government, strengthen Assad government's position, and then, from position of strength, negotiate, if necessary, in Geneva. While the intention is to strengthen the hands of the Assad government, at the same time, the Russians are trying to send a message. The message is, we have now come back to a position of strength where we can attack positions from this far away, and we are willing and able to take the chances and the risks that are required to do it. So we have to look at it in a much wider sense than just looking at it from a narrow Syrian point of view. I concede and I agree that the purpose there clearly was soften up the fixed positions of the opposition, including of Islamic State, and then move in. But remember, Idlib and Hama are not necessarily places where the ISIS or the Islamic State is highly concentrated. It is really the other opposition groups which are concentrated. The point is, weaken them, and after you have weakened them and have forced them to combine and join with the Assad government position, then go after the Islamic State. It's a very risky proposition.
Is that going to unravel U.S. policy of backing these anti-Assad opposition fighters?
The realities on the ground are much more complex today than they were, say, 2 weeks ago. One of the important things is that the position of the opposition, especially the secular opposition and the opposition which could call the moderate opposition, has been weakened. And at this stage, they are not being provided the adequate military and political support that is needed for them to withstand it, which could very well then mean that Islamic State could very well take advantage of this position and move in areas which have now been vacated or weakened because of the Russian attacks. So we have to see how things go. It's all very confusing, all very complex at this moment. But what we can say, though, is that the Russians and their supporters of the Assad government have moved with a resolute force. Whether that turns out to be the right thing to do and whether it brings about what they expect it to bring about is anybody's guess. But my concern in this is the following. In case this fails, then we have a much more serious problem on our hands where the international intervention will have been considered as futile, as useless, and under those circumstances, the Islamic State's hand will be strengthened.
Turkey's airspace has been violated a number of times by Russian warplanes. How alarmed is Turkey?
Very alarmed, and for two reasons. One of those is, of course, that their territory and their sovereignty has been violated. But other thing which one has to be very careful about is the following. Turkey depends up to 50% of its gas needs, natural gas needs, from Russia. If it creates a situation where Russia and the conflict between Russia and Turkey takes place, then Turkey could potentially lose access, if not all, a part of that gas, the same way as Russia played its hands and its cards in the case of Ukraine. So under those circumstances, Turkey has to be very careful. And that would imply that it may actually play a much more cautious game than one would have expected Turkey to do.
And Zubair says Russian backing should help improve both morale and recruiting for the Syrian army, which up to now has been on the defensive. He says if the army improves, it will likely mean the need for using Russian ground troops in the form of advisors and volunteers will lessen.
Thank you very much, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
For more on the latest developments in the Syrian conflict, Michael Lippin is here with a look at what's getting attention on social media. Michael, what stories are people tweeting about today?
Hey, Susan, I have got two articles for you. The first is a piece by the French news agency AFP that was tweeted by Arabic TV network Al Arabiya English. The tweet says, more than 70% of Russians support Moscow's bombing campaign in Syria. And in the article linked in that tweet, AFP says that figure comes from a new opinion poll published on Thursday by the independent Levada Center. It says the study was conducted just days after Russian President Putin secured permission from parliament to launch airstrikes in Syria. The poll found that 72% of respondents said they approved of the bombing campaign, and that 46% said they agreed with a decision by parliament's upper house to allow Putin to use force abroad. But the pollster also cautioned that those figures likely reflected the public's reaction to Moscow's latest TV propaganda rather than reflecting more genuine support for involvement in what could be a very protracted conflict. Now, the second article that I found on Twitter is by the Reuters news agency, and it was tweeted by the news site Christian Today. The headline in that tweet reads, Syrian army troops have coordinated with Russian airstrikes in their fight against the rebels. In that article, Reuters says Syrian troops and militia backed by Russian warplanes have mounted what appears to be their first major coordinated assault on Syrian insurgents. It says that assault happened on Wednesday and involved Moscow using its warships to fire missiles at those anti-Assad rebels from the Caspian Sea. Reuters quotes the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights activist group as saying the combined operation struck Syrian towns close to the main north-south highway in the mainly government-held west of Syria. Reuters also refers to a regional source familiar with the military situation in Syria as saying that the Iranian-backed Hezbollah militant group also took part in that fighting. And just before I go, I'd like to tell our listeners that you can find me on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. And please also check our Facebook page. It is VOA Asia. Back to you, Susan.
Thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The 2015 Nobel Science Prizes were announced this week in Sweden. William Campbell and Satoshi Omura share one half of this year's Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for their work in finding a unique method to fight infections caused by roundworm parasites. Yu-Yu Tu was awarded the other half of the prize for her discoveries that may lead to an innovative therapy against malaria. This year's Nobel Prize in Physics goes to Takaki Kajita and Arthur MacDonald for their research on atomic particles called neutrinos. And the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to Tomas Lindahl, Paul Modrich, and Aziz Sankar for their work on DNA repair, which could lead to the development of new cancer treatments. This year's Nobel Prizes will be awarded on December 10th in a ceremony that will be held in Stockholm, Sweden. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The United States continues to support efforts by the United Nations Special Envoy to Yemen to bring together Yemenis to de-escalate the conflict, which will also significantly help the humanitarian situation. The U.S. said it is calling again on all parties to participate in these peace talks without any preconditions. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy followed a discussion of the war in Yemen at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee with former U.S. Ambassador to Yemen, Stephen Sesh. Mohammed joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
Say, the Saudi-led coalition is continuing its fight against Iranian-supported Houthis and their allies. Did Ambassador Sesh give any explanation for the reluctance to stop the fighting?
Yes, so in fact, he told the Senate committee that the Saudis and the coalition members are encouraged by what they see in terms of their victories on the ground to continue pressing and pressuring the Houthis harder and harder. Ambassador Sesh warned against the temptation to storm the Yemeni capital by force.
I think that would be an absolute disaster. It's a city of 2 million people with deep pockets of support for the Houthis and former President Saleh. I can't imagine what a ground assault would do other than lead to more deaths and more carnage in Yemen. I think it's very ill-advised.
Now, if the Houthis and their allies accepted the terms put forward for negotiations by the UN envoy, what should the U.S. do to bring the Saudi-led coalition to the negotiating table?
Well, Ambassador Sesh urged U.S. policymakers to make sure that any further arms transfers to Saudi Arabia come with significant strings in the form of commitments to engage productively in the peace talks.
Well, we don't have a lot of leverage. What I would use is the little leverage we have. And as I said earlier, if the Saudis do want a brand new supply of modern weaponry, we sit down with them and say, if you need this, we need to find out what your end game is. How can you bring this to a negotiated end? What can be a resolution that's not going to depend upon a military solution? And what is going to be a negotiation? What's it going to look like? Who's going to be at the table and who is going to be willing to make a concession? Neither party at the moment, I believe, is prepared to make the important concession.
Ambassador Sesh recommended a more forceful but private diplomacy away from the public eye to convince both sides to settle their differences at the negotiating table, leading to a national unity government that would include Houthis and pave the way for reconciliation.
Well, thank you, Mohammed, for following this discussion at the U.S. Senate.
Thank you, Sue.
Coming up on International Edition, are there any teeth in the U.S.-Chinese cyber agreement? And a milestone in country music. One of the most anticipated outcomes of Chinese President Xi Jinping's recent state visit to the U.S. was an agreement between the two countries to cooperate more closely on cybersecurity and put a halt to economic espionage online. Well, it sounds good, but some analysts are questioning whether the deal actually can deliver what it promises. International Edition's Doug Bernard covers the cyber world and joins us here in the studio to sort things out. Welcome, Doug.
Hello, Susan.
Hey, Doug, do you really think this can deliver? Does it have any real teeth to it?
Well, when the announcement was first made, it had all the trappings of a big event. There was President Obama and President Xi Jinping on the lawn of the White House touting this agreement. President Obama said this is progress, although both leaders said more needs to be done. It all sounded great, at least on paper. Well, when people actually began looking at the paper and at the framework agreement, or common understanding as it's officially called, they found that there's really not a lot of there. This is more an agreement, but between two parties that really can't seem to agree on much when it comes to cybersecurity.
Well, how can you actually monitor this sort of thing?
Well, that's a very good question. The United States is particularly concerned about economic espionage. Now, we all know that sort of traditional espionage, government to government, goes on and everybody just sort of winks at it. But the United States is very concerned about hacks they say are coming from China, and some government officials have alleged that Chinese officials are helping prosecute the theft of intellectual property. That doesn't sound like much, but these are business industry secrets that are worth tens, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars. The United States wants to end it. But the problem is, one of the big problems is it's very hard in the world of cyber to know where an attack is coming from, much less who is definitely behind it. So before you go pointing fingers or imposing sanctions on countries or other actions, you really have to know for sure and kind of lay out for the public that government X or industry Y is behind the hack. That's very, very difficult to do.
Well, you often come in and talk to me about hackers, but it always seems like somehow, some way, eventually, these hackers are able to get around things,
yes.
Firewalls and things like that.
Yes.
So how is this enforceable?
Well, this is another element I think that some analysts that we've been talking to are very concerned about. For there to be an enforcement mechanism, there needs to be some sort of idea of retaliation. Here are lines that we will not cross, and if you cross them, we will do this or that or some such. This agreement doesn't have any of that out there. And it also kind of lays bare one of the I think larger secrets that is that the definition of cybersecurity that China has and the United States have are very, very different. So I think what you have here is a very basic, fundamental difference of opinion about what cybersecurity is. Until there can be a meeting of the minds on that, it's hard to see how any agreement's going to have much teeth in it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doug, for visiting.
Yeah, happy as always.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? A rocket car called the Bloodhound, built to break the world land speed record of 763 kilometers an hour by going over 1,600 kilometers per hour. Mark Elvin is Project Bloodhound's lead mechanical engineer.
At 1,000 miles an hour, the wheel's going over 10,000 RPM. That's a radial G on the wheel of 50,000 times the force of gravity.
The car will have to cover 1.6 kilometers in just 3.6 seconds, putting immense strain on the car and the driver.
So we go from 1,000 miles an hour to zero in 1 minute. That requires a stopping force of 3G. If you take a family saloon, crash it into a brick wall at 30 miles an hour, that's a 3G impact.
To go faster than 1,600 kilometers per hour, the vehicle will have to travel faster than a bullet fired from a handgun. A date for the record-breaking attempt has not been set yet. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossan.
Legendary country music show in Nashville, Tennessee, just celebrated its 90th birthday. VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to talk about the milestone.
Well, if you've heard of legends such as Loretta Lynn, Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, many of these country music icons' work has been promoted to the world via a radio show called the Grand Ole Opry. Well, now this small radio show grew into a major concert venue and cultural institution, and this past week it celebrated its 90th birthday with all of the big stars in country music. VOA's Nikki Strong is here to talk with us about it. Nikki, how did it get so huge?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it was a small radio show back in 1925, and it was founded by George Hay. And it was a live radio show that featured performances from different country artists. It still airs on WSM AM, which had a huge signal, and it enabled the show to reach an exponentially large audience beyond Nashville, Tennessee. And in the process, it became a huge player in exposing and introducing the world to country music. And the Grand Ole Opry, as a consequence, is credited with helping to shape and define the actual genre. And in the process, it's become a source of inspiration for anyone who wants to perform in country music. Reba McEntire, who said she went to a Grand Ole Opry performance before she was a teenager.
Yeah.
And she saw it and said, I want to do that. And look where she is now. So it's been incredible. And Grand Ole Opry has become the pinnacle of a lot of country artist careers. To be inducted and asked to be a member of the Grand Ole Opry is like being inducted into the Hall of Fame. It's selective, it's elitist, and it's a huge, huge honor.
And now it's moved around a lot, too. It's had 6 homes in 90 years.
Yeah. I think by the time I'm 90, I probably will have moved about 6 times at least as well. It has had 6 homes. At first, it was at the National Life and Accident Insurance Company back in 1925. And then it moved several times between 1934 and 1943. It landed at the Ryman Auditorium before it actually settled into its current Grand Ole Opry House in March 1974. I think one of the cool things about it is that when it moved from the Ryman to its current location, a 6-foot circle of oak was cut from the stage at Ryman and inserted into the new stage at the Grand Ole Opry. So by preserving a piece of the Ryman stage, generations of country music singers can perform on the wood where their legendary predecessors
performed.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
A lot of memories there.
Yeah.
Well, is it just country music artists that have performed at the Grand Ole Opry?
No, actually, I mean, it's primarily a country music venue. That is its claim to fame, and that's where it's committed. But actors and actresses and other singers as well have graced the stage. President Richard Nixon, actually, was at the Grand Ole Opry, as well as actor Kevin Bacon, James Brown, Stevie Wonder, Kevin Costner, Robert Duvall, just to name a few.
Yeah, quite a variety of performers or visitors there. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you can reach Nikki Strong on Twitter at @VOA_music and on Facebook at VOA Music. You can also hear her on VOA's Country Hits USA. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
Elvira. Elvira. My heart's on fire for Elvira.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll on down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In too many countries around the world, criminals have built great empires on laundered funds to infiltrate and corrupt government institutions. In this shadowy illegal economy, said David Luna of the State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, traffickers and narcotics kingpins act as CEOs and venture capitalists while they build their empires of destruction. These illicit activities have taken over a significant chunk of the world economy. According to various international organizations, the illegal economy accounts for 8 to 15% of the world gross domestic product. And in many developing countries, it may account for higher percentages in their economies. The World Trade Organization estimates that the value of counterfeit and pirated goods alone is equivalent to some 7% of the world's merchandise. This darker side of global trade is thriving with hundreds of billions of dollars in illicit commerce that includes trafficking in narcotics, persons, and endangered wildlife, among other goods and commodities. Simply put, illicit trade is an obstacle to shared prosperity by breeding corruption and siphoning capital and human resources away from legitimate economic activity. The best way to combat illegal trade is through collective action. This includes strengthening cross-border cooperation to tackle illicit commerce and help communities to seize the benefits of open trade to achieve sustainable development and security. Country implementation of the WTO's Trade Facilitation Agreement will play a critical role in this process. The United States will continue to enhance international cooperation with key partners to combat the lethal nexus of organized crime, illicit trade, corruption, and money laundering, and to protect communities from the violence, harm, and exploitation brought about by transnational networks. The U.S. will do this by enhancing its efforts to break their corruptive power, attacking their financial underpinnings, following the money and stripping them of their illicit wealth, and severing their access to the financial system. At a time when global risks are growing and converging, the international community must come together and build its own network to stand up to and defeat the dark world of illicit trade.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.